tweet something that touched on a lot of people. The spontaneity of the response became amazing, right? So it is something that we need to keep looking at for every protest that springs up. What critical mass of the population are affected by this issue? The beautiful thing about Nigeria is that if we get a number of things right here, it could spark some sort of other social unrest across other regions of Africa who want to take a cue from what has happened here to see how it happened.
Hello and warm welcome to the first episode of the Powering Through podcast, which continues on the themes of the NOCAP blog on how power is mediated and renegotiated in the social media. This is part of a student project for a Communication for Development master's course at the Malmo University. My name is Dulce Betroso, and from my living room in Bristol, UK, on the 20th of October, I was able to interview Chinedu Anarado speaking to me from Abuja, the capital of Nigeria. Chinedu is a health communication specialist who has also worked in advocacy and public relations for international NGOs, the government and private companies. Chinedu holds a master's degree in media and communications. In this 40-minute clip, we discuss the current NSARS protest to stop police brutality in Nigeria, one of the biggest protests of the year 2020, and the bar is already quite high. The NSARS movement is also quintessentially digital. From the use of Twitter for coordinating the protest to using Bitcoin for crowdfunding after the government closed activist bank accounts. Celebrities and public figures from Cardi B to the Pope have tweeted about the events. I'm really grateful to Chinedu as one of the local activists for sharing his insights into the role the social media has played in what is described as a leaderless protest. You will notice that we don't remember to mention the pandemic once, which says something about the magnitude of this issue.
NSARS is basically the Twitter hashtag that's been used for a campaign in Nigeria around police brutality, whereby a lot of young people have lost their lives, maimed, extorted by government security forces, notably a tactical section of the Nigeria Police Force, set up around 1992 to help combat violent crime. They started off well and eventually graduated into a bunch of rogues or rogue officers who basically stopped people along the road, checked through their phones, trying to get an idea of their bank balances, but also levying trumped up charges of either being internet fraudsters or any form of crime, just to extort the people. Their actions or their activities take different colorations depending on what aspect of the country you go to. If you're in Lagos, it's much likely around taking people or railroading people to automatic teller machines, ATM ports, and extorting the monies from them just to buy their freedom, to as much as forcing people to do bank transfers to a specified account. Some ridiculous instances also suggested that some of these officers carry around POS machines, right? It's something that cuts across every demography in the country and has affected everything. But you also speak to the widespread corruption within the police force in the country, such that at whatever point you meet them, it's only a matter of a degree of the extortion that happens. Issues are not properly addressed. Crime reported at the police post are not treated. It's so bad that when people come across an accident scene or a robbery scene that people need, for which victims need help, they don't want to render that help because they could be accused of being the perpetrators of such issues and then extorted or basically roped into things you don't know much about. It basically means that people's freedom to move around and relate is no longer guaranteed. You could be on your way driving and then an unmarked vehicle with a bunch of mufti-wearing officers wielding guns block your pathway, reroute you or beat you up and then ask you to send money to them and then threaten to kill you if you do not. So people basically walking on the streets and getting blocked up by police officers who push them into force, driving around the town, picking other people and then getting to a point where they are all extorted. The narrative suggests that these people have some sort of remittances to make to their superiors, and there's a remittance target set for each person or each police or each unit of those four. So government has not done anything to rein in on them, despite several protests, several complaints, several petitions, you know, to the police force. People are killed, maimed, families get people missing and they can't trace them. Police forces deny detaining people even when they're in their cells. And all manner of atrocities that you can think of visited on people that you are supposed to protect. So Nigerians are basically risen up, a final straw, saying that this is no longer tenable. On October 3, a young man called Joshua Ambrose was thrown out of a moving vehicle by these rogue police officers in Ugeni, Delta State, Nigeria, after he basically jumped. There's a narrative that says they pushed him out. Another says he jumped off the vehicle to avoid being extorted. And that sort of triggered the recent bout of protest. And that has now graduated into something of a huge magnitude that is basically gnawing at all the foundations of the country.
So it sounds like sort of police brutality, a huge young population, lots of young people out of work, lots of mobile phones seem to be like the perfect conditions for something like this to happen. But what exactly triggered the End SARS movement? What sort of like made it take off in the online world?
I think that social media is quite at play, or actually at the center of everything that has caused the sort of uproar, right? So if I would try to analyze this, I would try to put it side by side with the capabilities that you find in traditional media, right? So instances where pictures or live videos from activities happening are immediately shared on social media and then starts getting retweeted or being shared across board, then leads to people getting enraged, calling out the police handle, calling out the president of the country, calling out all responsible officers to actually rein in on what people are doing to stop such atrocities from happening. So it's that spontaneity of social media. It's that democratized space that it offers. It's the fact that it is a leveler and that it allows for that two-way communication that's missing with traditional media, whereby in most cases or in such a... So, for example, in our instance, government tries to rein in on what happens within TV, radio, or the prints, right? So social media breaks that barrier. And in this instance, and in our own case, everything about NSAS has happened on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. The photos were shared there, the stories were told there, the stories were fact-checked and verified there. Those who know come in to validate the stories or narratives being given with evidences, picture evidence, video evidence, voice notes, right, of things happening and basically people tweeting and seeing that this is what's going on. Everything that has happened about NSAS is actually a clear demonstration of the power of social media as an aggregator, as a coordination platform, but as also some place where people can come in that could help bring accountability on the front burner. Like I narrated on how this activity or how this protest started, a young man was jumped out of a vehicle believed to be a vehicle of police officers who wanted to extort him. And persons on the roadside basically captured what had happened. And it was on Twitter in a matter of minutes, basically triggering deep-seated sentiments against the police and people coming forward to recall their experience in hands of police and as a result of police brutality. So that sort of sparked off another round of conversations. People began to call the police force into question. And while that was happening, all the activities around the axis where this thing happened came to a halt because protests started. Those in Lagos camped in front of the government house in Ikeja, Lagos, and slept there for 3 days, asking government to do something about tactical police squad that had been abusing citizens. But while that was going on, images or videos from what was going on, they kept pouring onto Twitter, showing what was happening. And the conversation kept expanding, went viral, and everybody basically started coming forward with their stories. Then the protesters in Abuja aggregated themselves. If you check the Twitter and Abuja protesters, Abuja protests, you would see a series of arrangements or organizations being made under that hashtag. So Abuja protesters decided to gather 2 Saturdays ago under Beggar Bridge, and from there began to march across the city and then ended in front of the police force for headquarters, right? Images from that activity also went on social media. The next place we had, I think, was Benin, who came onto the scene organizing their own protest. Then it spread to Oka, spread to Enugu. Celebrities joined the fray, contributing their voices. A special icon was developed by Twitter for Nigeria. Social media icons or celebrities from across the world joined in the conversation. And before you knew it, it went viral and became a burning issue. But it also allowed us to put government on the spot. And by Sunday after the Wednesday that the Lagos protest started, government decided to act, right? And decided that they were going to disband the squad and proscribe the tactical units. And nobody believed that. And immediately, evidences of previous disbandments and bans and code of conduct came onto social media, I think about 4 times, from 2015, 2017, 2018, and 2019. And the central message was that we cannot trust government to keep stay put on its words. And then narratives of how a judicial panel of inquiry was set up, and the report was still sitting with the president, with recommendations on who to demote and who to sack. And that sort of infuriated people for that. And then the protest protracted. More cities joined in. More voices came onto the scene. And it began to affect economic activities across the cities. Then government decided to respond with force. So yesterday, some police officers went to Lekki after a curfew was declared and tried to disband peaceful protesters with live bullets. And somebody there basically went on live video on Instagram, showing a video of what was happening and allowed people to get enough evidence to hold government to account about what it was doing. Instantly, we started seeing the Nigerian army branding the images of shooting people as fake news. And immediately on the same tweet, videos of what happened were being posted, pictures were being posted, and all whatnot. So it has acted as a trigger, as a coordinating point, but also as an opportunity for people to fact check things. It helped those agitations to control the narrative of what was happening, extracted everyone from an echo chamber to be able to perceive exactly the narratives or sentiment from other parts of the country. So at the center of everything about NSAS has become is social media. At the center of everything that has happened has been social media. Even the response for support services, the crowdfunding for the monies used to bail out people who were detained during the protest, the ambulance services that were procured to take people who were wounded or shot, food and meals served at some of these gathering points were all coordinated, crowdsourced, and marshaled out of Twitter. So it shows us the strength, the ammunition that the social media has become, either for good or for bad. But in this instance, it has been something for good. We stand at the center of everything that has happened, a generation that has decided to take their battle using the new tool that technology has conferred on them, bypassing the traditional media and not even bothering a lot to call them. I mean, there has been instances where TV stations, we are now being accused for funny headlines, or radio stations, newspapers are being accused of funny headlines. TV stations, we are accused of running different programs, taking away attention from the critical thing happening. But even people from older generations are now circulating information on WhatsApp, asking questions about what is happening, watching videos about what was recorded from somewhere else, taking away constantly or ebbing away at the power that traditional media initially had, and taking away the ability of government to actually try to control the narrative, or basically pummel everybody to fit into the propaganda that he wants to sell around a particular concept. So that's actually the value, the accountability that social media has brought about to this campaign, but also across every other aspect of governance and our socio-political life in the country, even across the world.
It's really interesting how you describe that Twitter in particular has been a tool for coordinating fact-checking and basically the democratization of the information and media space, but then also that Twitter itself as a corporate has weighed in by introducing this icon, which seems interesting and unique, given that, for example, Facebook has always seemed to sort of struggle to take any stance on any social justice issues, and often maybe almost been a hindrance or a catalyst for brutality and hate speech and so on. Why do you think that it was Twitter?
I will try to answer the question by basically analyzing, one, the features of each platform, but also the category of persons who operate on across each platform. Mm-hmm. So Facebook became the first social media platform that a major part of the population knew about. So you would find all manner of conversations going on Facebook, but somehow, it lost something. I think it lost the excitement that it came with, which Twitter then tried to plug. So Twitter then became sort of micro-blogging platform that allowed for spontaneity, excitement, and allowed for us to discuss issues against a particular heading or currency. So I can respond to somebody's tweet and share it across other platforms. There's something unique about how Twitter is designed that allowed for the spontaneity, for excitement to be sustained over a period of time. And that is what Facebook has lost. Now, Instagram is largely what I choose to define as the show of space. So everybody's life on Instagram looks perfect with mm-hmm. airbrushed images and all that. So it was a place to share pictures of the beautiful things happening in your life, and as the case may be, the things you want everyone to share. Twitter is actually some sort of leveler, right? People say things the way they wanted to say it. It didn't matter whether there was errors or not. They wrote long chain of conversations over 140 characters under a heading, whereby everybody who follows somebody can easily join a conversation. But I think the critical mass of difference across these platforms is the fact that one offers you spontaneity and more excitement on the go. And a lot of people tend to think that, from my assessment, Twitter tend to also tend to aggregate a number of persons who could basically sit back and analyze issues in a short, direct manner, right? I can afford to write a full article that could easily go on Medium, on Facebook, and basically get people disinterested. But on Twitter, it's short 140 characters with short attention span, people basically digging into, putting in their thoughts and moving on, right? So the critical difference that Twitter made is actually the fact that it was more spontaneous about activities and response. And that is also in Nigeria, where the critical mass of the voices that really matter within the influencing space, right? That is where they are all playing. That's where they are aggregated. So it's a factor of the nature of the platform, but it's also about who and who plays what here. You would find less and less of the people who make things happen on Twitter and Facebook. You see less of them on Instagram. Or Instagram is just driven by images or pictures, which quite strong in its own way, has its own value and has a lot of users. But the spontaneity that issues of social dimension require, right, are much more available on Twitter than any other place.
And there hasn't been such a surge of TikTok as there has been in the US and in the US election, run up to the US elections.
TikTok is not quite popular. Let me use the word in Nigeria. I don't want to globalize. I don't want to make it an African issue. Even though I suspect it's in TikTok is available to users here, but it's not as popular as Instagram. It's not as popular as Snapchat in Africa. It's not as popular as Twitter or Facebook in Africa. TikTok is still an emerging concept, and it needs to come with something particularly special or different in order to suck in the African market. All right, so it's still a US thing where data, the conversations around data has now gone to a point where it's very common. I suspect the time it takes to create some of those videos that make TikTok what it is and make it exciting requires some level of professional effort and timing, which a lot of people in the West may have had or have, and data to create some of those things. Down here, it's not sitting in. People will prefer to actually design some of those videos and put them on YouTube. Mm-hmm. All right. So it's a factor of the much more prevalent platforms or much more popular platforms in which directions of the world. Africans don't already have its own social media platforms made for Africa by Africans. It's still not in existence, or if it's still in existence, it hasn't accepted that popularity. So we're sticking to the initial products that came into force from the get-go. A new product will need to struggle a little bit with some level of changes or adjustment or something really excitement to be able to key into the African market. So TikTok has some users here, but not as much as you have in the US. And I do not think that it has gained that level of followership or strength to control or basically have that power to control political behavior or social behavior at the proportions that the likes of Twitter, now has.
Understood. So that's obviously one difference between what's going on in Nigeria at the moment and then some of the other uprisings and movements around the world. It's in sort of the different platforms that get prominence. How would you sort of more broadly compare this movement with other recent protest movements around the world?
Well, so we are looking at other movements, for instance, what's going on in Hong Kong, right? Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the current uprising in places like, Thailand. There's this European country that is protesting after their recent presidential election. I'm trying to remember the name again. That's by the way, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a concept that emerged out of Hong Kong, and which a lot of people suggest, and also Black Lives Matter, which a lot of people suggest is the reason why some of these protests became sustained over a prolonged period of time. And this is the concept of the strategy of leaderless protests, so that nobody can come out to say that these are the level of, these are the number of influencers or number of critical voices who you can speak to be able to get this under control. Remember, the responses were spontaneous and organic. So it wasn't somebody saying, right? Somebody sitting in one place and saying, let's plan this thing. Okay, we will go to this point and this point. It was a bunch of people basically who could relate to the issues at stake, and there were a lot of them, taking a hashtag and figuring out where somebody has said we would aggregate. Of course, someone designed the banner to bring everyone together, but nobody has been able to come out to say, I was the one who did this. But you could see it on someone's handle. But you never know where it was coming from, right? I could easily download it from that page, share it, or put it on my WhatsApp profile or Instagram platform, say, this is where we are aggregating. Everybody who can, please come out and join us. And that is how all the protests have been coordinated and convened. The concept of leaderless protests seem to have come to stay. And it also made it difficult that a few people who went into a meeting with government to try to figure out how to contain the protests and came out to say this is what they discussed at the meeting were immediately discredited, and nobody lent any support to what they did. Say thank you to them, but basically said, you know what, you don't represent us. This is a leaderless concept. And when government tried to come out to address people, who said, there's no leader here, address every one of us, right? And that also led to the 5 for 5 demand from government, which was put out there and said, these are the 5 things that we are asking for. And there's someone, a bunch of people who are basically ticking off, showing out to what extent that each demand has been met or not met. There's also a bunch of handles of people who came together to coordinate the support services that have helped sustain the protest. So the ambulance, the legal, the health, the food, and the crowdfunding that contributed to being able to pay for the services, the private security entities that were hired to be able to man protest ground and prevent hoodlums from infiltrating the ranks, right? Someone coordinated all these things, but one specific, in fact, a call center was set up for people to call in if they are either in trouble or needed some sort of support. Someone coordinated, 1 or 2 or 3 persons, but they will tell you clearly that we don't own this thing. It is not us, and we do not speak for anybody. So think of it as we borrowing something that has happened elsewhere and ensuring that it works here. The other thing about this thing is the fact that there is a commonality of sentiments. You would always look and see some sort of economic undertone to some of these protests. So the concept of Black Lives Matter was putting in center stage the plight of colored people or blacks and the economic outcome, for instance, in the US. The same thing with the George Floyd protests that sort of fused into Black Lives Matter and spread out all over the world, basically saying that if he was white, he would not have been killed. In Nigeria, this is about speaking to a broad range of socioeconomic issues, lack of jobs, poor economic outcomes. People who even go out of their way to earn a living are basically extorted by government security forces. People are now lacking their freedom. One aspect of the country is pulling the other back from moving forward. Basically, people launching the capacity they have to make something out of their lives, right? So you would constantly see economic undertones to some of the things that are happening and how it's helping to shape the level, the strength of the voice and the strength of the pushback from protesters who are resisting every form of placation before something before something changes or before they go off the streets. So these are some of the two key similarities I have seen from all that has happened. And just to be clear, some of these sentiments will either die off the way they started off, right? Mm-hmm. And dying off would not mean that the issues have not been fully addressed. It could be for us to go back and wait for the next incident of a similar nature to happen for those underlying sentiments to be triggered.
You mentioned fact-checking a couple of times, which suggests that there are probably also some untruths and misinformation going around. What about sort of other murkier aspects of the social media? It does also have that character which polarizes people. There's a specific phenomena that I've just only recently learned about, such as shadow banning, which has affected some Black Lives Matter campaigners, sort of when their post under hashtag Black Lives Matter sort of have been censored or taken off their feeds without their knowledge and things like that. Are these a feature at all in the current movement in Nigeria?
When you go into that direction, right, then you would then start looking at what the alternative or different narratives look like, right? So the way misinformation has been treated with NSAS protests is the fact that people wanted to prevent a scenario where they could give government an opportunity to discredit the movement. So everything that had a political coloration was discredited right from the get-go, right? And almost everybody who had something to do with the movement, including some of the protesters and those supporting it, distanced themselves from any sort of political affiliation so that government does not change the narrative and say that this is a bunch of politicians who lost elections that are championing this. So that was one thing that we were particularly careful about. Because the moment he gets into that prison, every other thing goes south. The second thing is the impact of what social media could do to discredit the narratives of different persons or basically making light of the plight of a lot of people who have suffered from police brutality. So people are independently fact-checking a number of things. And I'll give you two instances, right? A certain young man during the protest basically came forward to say that he's been arrested and that he needs help to be believed and then shared an account number of somebody or a lawyer who was supposed to help bail him out where he was. Somebody immediately, got onto that and tried to follow up with the information to ensure that something comes out of it and the guy is released. Only for us to discover that he was another young chap who was trying to take advantage of the situation for personal benefit. And he was immediately discredited. Mm-hmm. Right? There was also another information about the number of military persons who invaded the Lekki Toll Plaza Ground Zero for the protest to disperse the protesters. A certain senior military officer was being bandied around as being the commander of the troops that went there. But it later eventually emerged that he came to the scene to disperse the soldiers who came there and was constantly shouting his name and his rank to the troops who were there to cease fire and stop shooting as a recognition of who he was, right? And the narrative suggested that when he saw what was happening, he suspected that no one authorized that that movement against protesters and decided to come out and quell it. And that was immediately fact-checked and confirmed. And every narrative around that man is now being contained because that information went viral. Even pictures of him and his family came on social media, but I've seen a lot of people saying, you know what, take down pictures of his children and his family. They have nothing to do with this. But this is also the other narrative around his actions so that everyone should take note. Now, the name of another officer has now come into the picture, which could easily align with the level of the military personnel or military ranks who could oversee such an operation. You know, so these are some of the instances. I've also seen people fact-checking the narrative that the Nigerian army will not shoot any protester who has the Nigerian flag and flying it over them, or the fact that after 30 days, if the protest is sustained, the United Nations special forces will move in to contain the situation and all that. And people basically fact-checked and showed that they were wrong information, right? So invariably, for things not to get muddied in politics and for the level of strength of the agitators not to be discredited, people are making efforts to ensure that they're putting out the right information. And if you put out a wrong information, someone will ask you to validate or evidence what you've provided. And if it's not possible, someone is going to call you out. There is a plurality of people who are affected by the same sentiments. And the only other thing that is likely going to defeat that strength of unity of purpose on this issue is when it starts getting mired in ethnic undertones or a lot of people trying to force through a narrative that it's a bunch of people who want the president to leave power that are driving the NSAS movement. You know, so we are quite very, very conscious of that, and it's going to be shut down if it comes up, and we'll hold it out for as long as it's possible.
How is the government responding to this, not just to the issue, but to the fact that people are engaging with them through social media? Are they taking it seriously?
There's an analysis that I have seen that suggests that, on the contrary, they may have ceded the social media space or haven't made any particular effort to try to gain some level of control over the narrative on there, right? So the sort of infiltrations that you would normally see from intelligence agencies like the Department for State Security or the National Intelligence Agency is completely missing, right? I get a sense that government is afraid of engaging on social media. A few government actors or a few government appointees or government cabinet members who are on there basically using the platform to showcase what they're doing or basically try to drive or political conversations, right? But when it comes to trying to hold constructive discussions around what government is doing and what social services government is providing, we have not seen the depth of engagement as you would normally want to see. For instance, if someone is giving a press briefing on TV or radio, as the case may be. I recall running a campaign or being on the campaign team of an aspirant some 3 years ago for my home state. And I knew that every evening on Saturdays, we held Facebook Live sessions for followers to ask questions about his ambition and his plans for the government. And that has not happened, right? Rather, you would see a bunch of young people who are managing social media platforms for their principals. So from the president to the vice president to the Senate president to the National Assembly, government cabinet ministers, you can count a number of them who use their social media platforms themselves. Rather, they'd rather hire a number of people who would basically dish out pre-composed Twitter threads, or Facebook posts, and then move on. There is not that deliberate effort to make for a two-way conversation between the leader and the led, or the leader and followers. And there are one or two reasons I can adduce for that. The first one is that most of the appointees are actually either in their 50s or 60s and are naturally not people you could define to be digital natives, right? The second thing is that there are still a critical mass of persons, right, who are out of the social media. Most people on the lower class do not have that patience or time or haven't learned the currency of, for instance, Twitter posts. You could find a number of them on Facebook, but not on Twitter. Mm. So elections or political power can still be secured by passing the critical mass of young persons who are on social media. I've seen a spokesperson for the Lagos State government saying, you guys, we are on here chanting NSAS without realizing or coordinating with a number of locals, right, who do not understand the language you speak here. What that means is that a bunch of people who are not on social media has now suddenly converted their grievances against the police into a violent manifestation. You see, so that demonstrates the complexity of the situation, the value of social media, and those who are not yet on social media. Until we get to that point where political power, just like in the US, I want to assume, where political power can be won and lost on social media, right? We may not get to a point where we force them to actually engage, right? For now, it's purely down to reputation management and public relations, the role this thing plays in government. Because I do not see a time coming, if government knows it can, government actors or politicians know they can win elections by just going into the grassroots and campaigning and, you know, getting people into direction, into one place, right? If that does not come, or if the critical mass of those voters do not come on social media and are influenced by the narratives on that platform in terms of their voting decisions, we may not be able to arrive at the point where we get government to sit down on the same table and speak with us.
Why do you believe that the No SARS movement will not fade out in the same way some of the other previous movements, such as Bring Back Our Girls a few years ago, have sort of fallen into public oblivion?
Every independent agitations that either are simmering or sort of suppressed across the country, right, relate or can manifest themselves in police brutality. So that even if the conversation goes off the front burner on social media, it may still remain on the street. And if it goes away on the street, it will remain on social media. The only thing that can guarantee that this will not come back again, because it is a current issue, it's living, is if the level of impunity we see from government security forces, especially policemen, do not replicate itself, at least at the magnitude that triggered some of these violent manifestations. If that happens, it will only take one or two incidences being shared on social media coming from different angles for this to come back on the front burner again, right? So this is why I believe that this won't go away. The issue of Bring Back Our Girls is something affecting one section of the country, let me say a state, affecting about 300 girls, as important as it is, as valuable as their lives are, right? For as long as there are no Boko Haram strikes or Boko Haram issues, that may never come back again. It may have lived its lifespan, unfortunately. And this is something that should have been kept on the front burner. However, unlike police brutality, it happens to everyday people. Upper class to an extent, middle class at a large level, lower class to an extent that you can't even imagine, because a number of things that happen there are suppressed. And people take it as some of the factors of living in a third world country or in a developing country. But for as long as something of that nature keeps pricking those issues and coming back on social media, the whole thing that is happening now, the whole NSAS movement, will keep coming back onto the front burner, at least until government does something.
Mm-hmm. So something that's truly unique about this movement, that the fact that it resonates at the national level and it resonates across social classes, and as we have seen, it resonates globally as well.
The moment we preached something that touched on a lot of people, the spontaneity of the response became amazing, right? So it is something that we need to keep looking at for every protest that springs up. What critical mass of the population are affected by this issue? I'm cautiously optimistic that this could be a trigger for widespread changes in our political life, behavior of political actors, and how the 2023 elections could be shaped. But that could change if, after the curfew is lifted and this tension goes away, the conversation is taking back seat. But if it keeps coming back onto the front burner and the protesters keep coming back onto the streets, then we are in for a very long ride, and it could lead to systemic changes. The beautiful thing about Nigeria is that if we get a number of things right here, it could spark some sort of other social unrest across other regions of Africa who would want to take a cue from what has happened here to see how it happens. I don't know, but I don't want to hold a lot of hope so it's not dashed, right? Because we've seen sparks of light in the past, but nobody has seen anything to the magnitude of what this thing has come down to.
Well, that's probably a great note to end on. And you mentioned there Nigeria's position in the whole sort of geopolitical context. It's a huge country, huge young population, so holds a lot of promise and hope for the world. But then at the same time, it's also a very dangerous situation. So I guess we can only just, from distance, we can just hope and pray and support you guys so that we'll get to a good outcome.